Some days it's interest rates, some days it's the share market, some days it's the price at the servo. But the business story is never just business. I'm Carrington Clark, host of ABC Business Daily. From Monday to Thursday, I'm joined by the ABC's business reporters to break down the biggest stories in business, finance, and the economy. And on Fridays, Alan Kohler jumps in the chair for That's Business, sitting down with industry leaders, movers and shakers, CEOs and founders to talk to the people leading and building the economy. All in the same ABC Business Daily feed. Find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome back to History or Hoarding. I'm Annabelle Crabb in Australia's oldest library. Methodist Church, Methodist Church.
See the amazing things in the collection.
Oh, it smells. Do you smell that?
It really smells.
If we can just walk down here and I'll show you.
Literally, we are following Maggie's nose right now. Deep underground in the quiet, cool stacks, a part of the collection is quietly dying.
So you can smell this?
Oh, my God, it's really strong.
Whoa, that's very strong and pongy. The smell is an unmistakable, acrid stab of vinegar straight to the nostrils. And I'm not talking about like opening a jar of gherkins type of vinegar. I'm talking the kind of vinegar that comes in a 2-litre bottle and you use it to clean your drains.
So you can see we're actually testing for vinegar syndrome here. And this is what happens with old microfilms. The film is just degrading, so that's where you're getting that vinegar smell.
It's so weird because 100 years ago, storing documents and images on microfilm was a cutting-edge technology that promised to outlast paper.
You know, before we could digitise materials, they were microfilmed, and they've been doing microfilming since the 30s. And so they would photograph an item or a series of journals or newspapers, and then they would transfer it into a microfilm reel like this. And that's how you would access it, and you'd look at a microfilm reader in the reading rooms.
During World War II, British libraries rushed to preserve their collections on film in case their buildings were blown up. Who knew that this stuff would turn out to have a long-term problem with pickling itself?
And so it's something that all institutions are dealing with, is the gradual deterioration of the early microfilm collections.
Yeah. So you've got it's basically a race against time to preserve what's on there.
Yes, it is.
Today's librarians, though, have to grapple with something much bigger than the old problem of what lasts longer, a piece of paper or a photo of a piece of paper. Increasingly, they're tussling with a new problem. How do you collect and preserve and protect things that have never been on paper? Digital material. There's a corner in every one of our phones right now, every single one of us, where our lives are piling up. A photo of a meal nobody actually needed to photograph, 400 screenshots of things we're definitely gonna read later, the complete text message record of a relationship from its first shy punctuation to its last. We are all in our pockets, holding more than any human being in history has ever held. Our phones are increasingly replacing all of the physical public squares where our interactions and our history used to take shape. Emails instead of letters, tweets and Facebook posts instead of newspaper listings. These are all things the library wants to collect, things that are within the library's remit, but they're things that can evaporate or just slip through the cracks so easily.
If we don't capture that, then that's kind of a digital dark age, because we're going to have this point where the physical stuff has run out and the world went digital. Mm. So if we're not collecting the digital, then we're not collecting our history.
Today, a conversation with a digital archivist, someone who's quietly running this impossible race against time to save our digital lives. Okay, so let's begin. Can you tell me who you are and what you do?
I'm Matthew Burgess and I'm the lead digital archivist at the State Library of New South Wales. I've been at the library for 12 years now, which is not long compared to other people working at the State Library.
Matt is definitely part of a new-ish phenomenon in an institution where tastes run instinctively towards old stuff.
The Digital Preservation Lab, as we call it, used to be a stationery cupboard and a small meeting room.
Right.
But we've got three workstations in there. It has secure swipe access because we don't want people kindly turning off our computers when we're running processes overnight.
Oh, has that happened?
Yes.
Can you just obviously de-identify the guilty, but like, can you please tell me about when that happened? Start from the beginning.
So when I started in this team in 2017, I was tasked with analysing, you know, what does the library already have on our network drive, the collections that we need to manage. And, you know, there's a lot of data there. And so I needed to run a particular process on that was going to take days. And so I just left my computer running in an open office. And then came in the next morning and it was turned off.
To save power?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why we need a secure space so that people can't touch things.
I love how, like, we spent time in the strong room, which is fantastic, which is like a mixture of things that need to be protected from the public who might nick them and things from which the public needs to be protected, like dirty books and letters. But you need security on your door. Just in case somebody who's trying to save power comes
and turns off your computer. Yes. Yeah.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
So the stuff that Matt and his team do in the Digital Preservation Lab is different from just taking a physical item and scanning a copy of it so you have a digital version. That is stuff the library does, but that is not Matt's main challenge. Matt's job is to harvest what he calls, and the pros in the biz call, born digital content. Stuff that's never ever been on paper, never been in the physical world. And trying to save that kind of stuff is maniacally more complicated than just putting an object onto a shelf. Think about trying to capture a website, for instance, like the ABC's website, something that contains an awful lot of information but changes and shapeshifts every day, every hour, every minute.
You know, you've got the images, you've got links to other resources, and it's kind of like, where do you stop in terms of trying to capture information? But also, how do people access that? Some websites are not really great at letting you scrape them. So there's a lot of complexities there.
In my time researching the State Library of New South Wales, I've walked past boxes and boxes and boxes of the papers and diaries and mementos and sometimes hair samples of famous writers. In those boxes, you could kind of see their ideas taking form and being edited and scribbled out and revised. But as we move online and use computers to type our ideas up and revise them to send our thoughts in emails rather than letters, our historical paper trail is changing. What does a significant person's archive now look like?
It could literally be anything because each individual works, like their creative process is different. Yeah. So they might use different programs, they might communicate differently, they might use different online platforms even to kind of, you know, do storyboarding. One collection that we've acquired recently is from Charlotte Wood, and she uses a software program called Scrivener.
Oh, yeah.
So we kind of need to look at, you know, what's the software that they're using? Can it export things into more of an open or known file format? Because what we really want to avoid is people printing out their emails. And I can guarantee you we have printed out emails in boxes in SAC, which, you know, it's...
So is that just like you say, oh, hey, Charlotte Wood, thanks for sharing your archive. We'll be needing your email password and we'll just be scrolling through every single thing.
So we actually use the same tools that police use for digital forensics.
What?
In libraries. And this is used by the FBI. I've had training from some Texan FBI agent who came out to Australia and was training me and a few of my colleagues from the library. I think we had some people from the ATO and the fisheries and boating or something. Anyway, but what we're using it for is looking at that hard drive and trying to make a selection on what is relevant as an archive from that individual, whether it's a person or it could be a business or whatever. So that's kind of one approach. But another approach is to actually go to the author, and we did this with Charlotte Wood, and say, all right, organize your digital files for us in the same way that we would with the physical collection.
Mm.
So, you know, they don't just say, all right, here's all my stuff.
Mm.
Like, kind of the author has to go through it and work out what's there and help with that process of appraisal and selection. And then that'll get captured and stored in a database.
And then you print it out. Just messing with you. But seriously, I would like a printout. I think maybe I want the printed out version of my emails, because just the idea of diving through the digital hellscape that is my inbox sounds too daunting. And if I could just get it in front of me, print it out, cross some bits out with pencil, maybe it would all feel more manageable. But I do accept there are benefits to not just printing out the emails.
I guess the key thing with digital, and particularly with emails, like digital compared to a printout of it, you can do all this computational analysis. So if someone wants to come along and say, who were they communicating with when they were writing this book?
Mm.
They could put in a time frame of when this person might have been writing that book, and they can see all of the correspondence and relationships between emails and topics during that time period if we've captured it.
So I always think when thinking about the orthodox kind of archives of famous people, you always get this really interesting asymmetry, because you typically have half of an exchange of letters. You know, you have the letters that a writer received, and there's kind of gaps, because unless you've got the archive of the other correspondent, you're kind of guessing at what they might have said, and maybe their letters all got burned or whatever. So what are the ethical concerns when you've got all the emails that the person received and the ones that they sent? What does it mean for the breach of privacy for the other correspondent?
It was interesting, because this software is designed for police forensics, and so the power of this software actually raises some ethical concerns in a library context, because let's say Charlotte Wood gives us her laptop.
Mm-hmm.
We can then take a disk image, so a copy of that hard drive content, and put it through this software and do a big analysis of what's on this hard drive, what file formats are there, what are in those emails. The power of this software, and I guess the ethical thing that comes into it, is it can also recover deleted files.
Like if Charlotte Wood has deleted a file that relates to the time she shot a man in Reno just to watch him die, then there's your ethical question.
Yeah, it's even just a fact of, you know, people aren't aware that we can see deleted files necessarily. And that is not why we use this software.
Sure.
We're still kind of in the process of establishing how we're using this software.
Okay, so problem one is collecting this gargantuan, escalating explosion of digital material, finding it, pinning it down to the ground, and doing that all ethically. But there's another problem, a big one, maybe the biggest one, to be honest. It's the matter of hoarding digital things forever, which is not as easy as it sounds. It turns out my childlike faith that digital things, you know, things that are in the cloud, will live forever, is seriously, seriously misguided.
Basically, it doesn't matter whether something has been digitized, so that's a digital representation of a physical item, or if it's born digital, so created and maintained in a digital format, it needs digital preservation. So it needs active and ongoing care over time.
We walked with Maggie down deep in the bowels of the building. And she opened up these drawers of microfilm that smelled like vinegar. It was just pickly.
Yeah.
And that is the smell of microfilm
disintegrating.
So what's the equivalent of that in material that's always been online? How can they go a bit funny over time?
Yeah, so I mean, if we look at just digital files, they can have what we call as bit rot. So,
bit rot.
Files are, when it comes down to it, bits, ones and zeros, bytes. And just sitting there on a storage medium, doesn't matter what sort of storage medium it is, they can change.
Oh.
So there's high risk with digital material because you can't just put it on a shelf and leave it there for 10 years and expect it, A, to still be there and B, to even understand how to use it. It kind of requires active use and active care and selection and a whole bunch of things around digital preservation to maintain it over time.
Oh.
So part of, like, one of the important things in digital preservation is a term that we call fixity. And this is something that we check over time. So it's not just you check it once. You check it again and again and again and again over time because if you've got a file sitting on your hard drive can become corrupted and you can lose that file. So if you're constantly doing a fixity check to say these files haven't changed, then you're monitoring that and managing that over time.
And then you print it out. Sorry. I'll stop. Okay. So what, I mean, is there a permanent form of storage? There isn't. I mean, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Well, you don't know what the technology is. So, I mean, my team at the moment, we're working with collections that the library acquired in the 90s and early 2000s. So we're working with floppy disks. Oh. We're working with zip disks.
CD-ROMs.
Yeah, lots of CD-ROMs.
God, I love those.
DVDs, Blu-rays. Actually, things even earlier than that. Like, I've got 8-inch floppy disks on my desk.
Whoa,
which
I had never seen before. Who used 8-inch floppy disks?
Well, they're actually from what the labels say, because we don't have the technology to read them, but I believe they're early digital catalogs for the library. So they're actually library records.
Wow, but you don't know how to crack them open.
We can't access them because we don't have an 8-inch floppy drive.
I never thought about that. I mean, is it infuriating to think of all this information that's trapped on things that you can't read?
I mean, yeah, and I mean, even if you can get the drive, you then need to know, well, what operating system or computer system was used to create that. We do have material that was created on operating systems that no longer exist.
This particular headache is not just a problem for Matt or the State Library. It's a worldwide problem that institutions and individuals and governments are confronting. Horror stories abound.
One of the examples that pretty much gets taught to every information management specialist, so if you're studying to be a librarian or an archivist and there's a digital component to that course, they're going to talk about the Doomsday Project from the UK, where they brought together all of this documentation on UK culture and put it onto a laser disc, which you can no longer access. So this was supposed to be a project kind of documenting that period in time, and it used a bespoke technology that is no longer accessible.
I'm sorry. I love that. I love that. It's just such a human piece of brilliant stupidity.
Like, yeah.
We've got all of these movies. They're available on Betamax.
Yeah. It's the problem with technology, and particularly if you're trying to be innovative and use new technology.
Yeah.
How long is that technology going to be around for?
Okay, so it's obvious that we've gone through a phase of having disks and floppy things and hard drives that become obsolete. But then the cloud came along and sort of sorted out all our problems, didn't it? I mean, now that the data just kind of hovers in the cloud and it's not lashed to some fallible physical object, does it become immortal?
Not necessarily.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
Where is the cloud?
I don't know. I've never known. Can you tell me where is it?
It's a data center somewhere, whether it's in Australia, whether it's overseas, it's someone else's computer.
Okay, so you're telling me if somebody backs a semi-trailer into a data center, or there's a data center that gets sort of compromised in some way, then over the other side of the world, somebody's records or photographs could just go poof?
If they don't have a good digital preservation strategy in place, yes. So there's kind of a 3-2-1 rule with storage or copies. Mm. So you want 3 copies on 2 different technologies and 1 in a different location entirely, because you basically want multiple copies to account for natural disasters, like man-made disasters, whatever could happen to that data source. You know, there's documented examples of, particularly overseas, where I think it was Korea recently, they had a fire at a data center and there was a government mandate for all of their what's the word?
Come on, this is your field, mate.
All of the
computer thingy.
Yeah, all government for
dongle. Is it a dongle?
Well, no, just like institutions or organizations. They had to store everything in this data center.
Oh, right.
So it was mandated. You know, you must store everything in this data center
that we've just accidentally blown up.
That just caught on fire, and they didn't have backups.
Oh.
So there's nothing like a disaster story to make things happen, like to make people realize the value of their digital material.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because humans have always lived with the possibility that the inevitability that our memories and our experiences and our feelings will one day die, because they die with us, right? You know. A great mind with an incredible memory, full of bespoke experiences that nobody else knows about, when they die, is gone. You know, it's a disc that can't be read anymore. But now that we have the capacity to download, and so much of our brain activity is evident in the trail that we create behind us, it's kind of created an expectation that we'll be able to hang on to all that stuff. Is it worth it? Is it proper? Is it madness?
Well, I think people don't realize how ephemeral their digital lives are. So if you think about...
But they used to be just thoughts, and they were ephemeral.
Oh, well, sure. But I mean, if you think about family photographs, for example, you know, you have a Christmas gathering and someone takes some photos, you know, back in the 90s, it was on film, they would have got it printed and they would have given copies to people or made a family photo album. Now everyone's using their phones and you know the password to your phone, but someone else might not. Unless you have a legacy plan in place for someone to access your data when you pass away, then it goes with you.
Yeah.
And it's the same for social media. It's the same for your emails. It's the same for a lot of stuff. And if you don't think about that, and I think that's a challenge for me is working professionally in this space.
Mm.
I know about all this, and so I need to think about all this. And I have had to face it when my mother passed away, looking at Facebook and looking at photos and all that sort of stuff. So I think people just assume that because it's digital, it's going to be there forever. And it really isn't, unless you actively manage that over time and have a plan in place to continue that management when you're no longer here.
Collecting and preserving history used to be the job of institutions. Newspaper editors chose the articles, librarians chose what to include in their collections. Making history was sort of a closed shop. But now, in our digital age, those old limits are gone, for better or for worse. These days, we're all co-conspirators in this historical hoarding.
Earlier on in my career in digital preservation, I was kind of like, oh, you know, I need to preserve the State Library's collections in perpetuity.
Mm.
But then I realised, I'm like, well, no, my job is to do it while I'm working here. And doing it to the best of my ability with the information that I have at hand. And then it's the next person who comes into this role. It's their responsibility, and so on and so on.
Next time, on the final episode of History or Hoarding, a love letter to the nameless, the unimportant, the
fabulous nobodies.
And so I find this bunch of Valentine's cards and, oh my God, they were amazing because they were all written between one couple.
What?
It was one couple. Snuggle Bunny Frank and Princess Dorothy.
No.
Yes, they were their names for each other.
History or Hoarding is made on the lands of the Gadigal people. It's written and presented by me, Annabelle Crabb, with research by Julia O'Shea. Harvey O'Sullivan is our audio engineer. Rachel Cusick is our supervising producer. And Carmel Rooney is our executive producer.